historically known as a nomadic Muslims. The Central Asian version of Islamic belief is a mixture of culture, Islam, and traditions. Further, the Soviet occupation and the Islamization steps has blocked all possible avenues of Islamist infiltration in a form that it exists in the region's immediate neighbors. After independence, though, first in Tajikistan, later in Uzbekistan, we have seen a resurgence of Islam in various formats. Lately, increasing presence of Central Asians, first among the Taliban, later in tribal region of Pakistan, now in Syria, Iraq, in northern Afghanistan, paints a different picture of Islam in Central Asia. The question is, what went wrong with Central Asian states' religion policies and how it should look like going future? So this is the subject we will discuss in upcoming 30 minutes. I am Mohammed Tahir, Director of Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Joining me are my colleagues Bruce Panier, editor of our Central Asia blog, Kishlak Awazi, Ali Shir Siddiq, director of our Uzbekistan service. Welcome, gentlemen, here in the studio. Dr. John Hedershaw, associate professor of international studies at University of Exeter in London. Dr. John, welcome to the show.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Emil Jurayev, associate professor of political science at American University of Central Asia in Bishkek. Dr. Emil, you also welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Alisher, please help us get rolling the discussion. You were born in one of the most conservative societies in former Soviet Union, that is Uzbekistan, obviously. So what was it look like to be a practicing Muslim under the Soviet time in Uzbekistan?
I have to just recall what my parents were saying, you know, under Soviet time, as it was across the whole Union, the religion was very secondary on the agenda. So it was totally different ideology, very strong ideology, communist ideology, socialist ideology. So I wouldn't say that people were like suffering lack of religious freedoms, but since the powerful communist ideology was everything for majority of people, but of course they were part of people that were upset because under Soviet times it was not possible to be totally, you know, to practice Islam in the whole way, you know. So if you are the most interesting thing is that if you are like, if you want to be some manager on you know, high level yeah. positions, you obviously are not allowed even to attend any religious ceremonies. Even the death of your own parents, you have to carry out all this in a not in traditional way, but in very Soviet and secular way. So we heard a lot of stories that people like even President Karimov was not able to attend his own parents' death in a religious and traditional way. So that was it's quite known for many people that Soviet Union was terribly bad on religious freedoms.
Dr. Jurayev, is there anything you want to add to Alisher's point here? Obviously, you are talking from Kyrgyzstan.
Alisher definitely knows much more than I, having seen more of the Soviet Union experience. But I guess there was indeed a lot of restrictions in terms of religious practice in everyday life. Albeit, of course, all of the Soviet Union period was not the same, of course. For the later part of the Soviet Union, there was some, not to say liberalization, but slight freeing up of the public space, especially in everyday life, for practicing religious ceremonies. But that definitely did not amount to full religious freedom.
Let me add some facts here from Turkmenistan. In one of the academic papers, I learned that at some point there was only one mosque in Turkmenistan during the Soviet time. By 1996, which means 5 years after the independence, number of mosques went up to over 100. That was obviously, in response to the public demand. Like Turkmenistan, almost every country has revisited their religious policies after the independence. Dr. John Hedershaw, you had a long paper on states of Islam in post-Soviet Central Asian countries just 2 or 3 days ago at the Chatham House that you mentioned in a private conversation. So take us through to those adjustments by the Central Asian states after the independence to incorporate the Islamic feelings of the citizens. What was that? How it looked like?
I think there clearly was an Islamic revival, and it's important to understand that properly. Both Emil and Alisha mentioned that religion was secular in the Soviet experience, but it never went away. Scientific atheism never achieved the eradication of Islam in Central Asia, and never really tried to do that after about 1941, when it became important for Muslims to serve in the Soviet armed forces in World War II. So historians of Islam, such as Adib Khalid, and more recently anthropologists of sort of contemporary Islam, demonstrate that what actually happened was not just the destruction of Islam and Islamic expression in the early Soviet period, but its reconstitution in the late Soviet period through the establishment of a Council of Ulema and Muslim clerical boards, and a sort of secularization of Islam. So the important thing is not to see the secular and the Islamic as completely opposite, but to understand that secularism isn't about eradicating religion, it's about controlling it, making it subordinate to the state, and in the Soviet case, attaching religious identity to national identity. So religious identity drops down or is secondary to national identity. So to be Kyrgyz is to be Muslim. To be Tajik is to be Muslim. It is so in a more cultural way than a pietist way. Not a pietist way at all, actually. But that's still a recreation of Islamic identity during the Soviet period, which took place across the late Soviet period, and which generated certain kinds of Muslim practice and ideas. And we still see those in Central Asia today. So you have people who would concur with various secularist positions about the importance of a secular state and the importance of religion being subordinate to that state. And that's a Muslim view in Central Asia. That's not a secularist view. Or rather, it's both. It's the position of a secular Muslim. And in Central Asia today, most people are secularized Muslims. Interestingly, of course, there is also, and something we'll get on to talk, obviously pietist movements, revivalist movements, which are a little bit different. They're overwhelmingly non-violent, but that's in the post-Soviet period, as space opened up, that's what changes, and that's what's interesting to properly understand.
Yeah, in that point, I will come to Bruce, but Bruce, first, you want to add something to the discussion that so far we had?
Yeah. I mean, since we're going back to the early days and stuff, You know, I was doing research in villages, and I got there in March 1992, so the Soviet Union had only fallen about a half a year before that. And as part of the surveys that we were doing in these villages, I had a list of questions that I had to do, and I was remembering that I was working in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, and one of the questions was if they were going to build a new building in your community, and these were all villages of less than 2,000 people, what would you like to see? Across the board, it was a mosque. It didn't matter which country, it didn't matter which village, how far I was from a city or anything. That's what everyone wanted to have was a new mosque. Of course, they didn't. Because having been cut off from the greater Islamic world for all those years of being in the Soviet Union, Islam, and people have already mentioned that Islam never went away, and I was a little bit surprised but very encouraged to find out that when it came time for specific rituals, funerals, weddings, things like that, even early in 1992, none of that had been forgotten, and people understood exactly what the traditions were, and they went right back to it immediately. One of the big problems that I encountered when I was out there was the fact that because of there had been this lack of knowledge, people that didn't know a lot about Islam, and of course I had to study it in graduate school, but people that didn't know a lot about Islam but knew some of it, something about it, were held in very high regard. And for example, if anyone had done the Hajj, and people started to do the Hajj already in 1992 and 1993, these people would return to their local communities and give their interpretation of the Quran or what Islam was supposed to be about, and everyone readily accepted that interpretation because they didn't have anything else to compare it to. And in some cases, it was in conformity with the scripture. In other cases, there were biases or local prejudices that had been mixed in with it that I recognized immediately. But not being a Muslim, people weren't that interested in my particular opinion on that. But you could see that Islam was going to take very different forms in very different places in Central Asia just because of this variety of interpretations of the Quran. And certainly we see that's become one of the big problems in Central Asia today, is that there is no set script and people have accepted different interpretations as being the entire truth.
You mentioned Bruce and also Dr. John and Ali Sher and also Dr. Emil. So there was a revival of Islam to the region, or let's say in other words, that people were coming back to their religious identities. So where was the government's role in those things in responding to people's come back to their religious identities? What were they doing? It's open question for anyone who would like to take this.
If we talk about Uzbekistan, the government did not adjust its policy, but it was like, let's say, floating with the situation on the ground. You know, they see that Islam took a big part in people's life. Yeah. Immediately they noticed that. Yeah. For President Karimov, that was almost shocking. The guy was total communist background, very who would not understand even Uzbek language, you know, never say about Islam and stuff. He suddenly learned that the whole Fergana Valley is wants to become a caliphate, you know, and he travels to Namangan to discover people like Tahir Yildaz, Juma Namangani, who created their own small caliphates on the ground. What he did, he could not offer anything in ideological matter. You know, communism is gone. You cannot offer anything else to the people. So what you want to do, you want to use that. So what happened since then, knowing that Islam will be taking, having a big role in the society, he promised these guys to be, you know, to care about it, you know, basically. Yeah. So actually they did. The post Soviet policy on Islam was to trying to use that for your own purposes, to stay in power, to rule the government, you know, but don't allow them to come to power, you know, so that this is a very very delicate type of policy. So at the same time, keep it under control, you know, keep radicalization away. They suddenly viewed that as their main threat at the same time, because these guys had very good chances to come to power in the very beginning of independence. So it was very, very, I would say, a narrow policy in this matter.
Bruce, I just wanted to slip something in real quick. I agree with Ali Sher 100%, but I also remember that right after independence, and once the presidents were sure that this wasn't a trick and they wouldn't be reincorporated into some new Russian-led body, they actually threw the doors open to Islam in a lot of cases, because it was a way of distancing themselves from the former colonial master. They weren't Russians. They weren't part of a Russian empire or anything like that. They were Muslims, and they were distinctly different from Russia because of the fact that they embraced Islam. So to some extent, the governments welcomed this change, and in fact, as showing that they were distinct from the former empire.
Just
so finally,
to come in on that, if I may.
Sure.
I think that highlights how the nationalist and culturalist understandings of Islam, sort of, which strengthened during perestroika, then continue in the post-Soviet era, where for states, they're happy with Islam to the extent that it's a sort of, it's a factor in their culture. But the problem is then for the Soviet trained, you know, sometimes quite assertively or militantly secular elite, they don't know how to deal with Islam when it becomes more pious, when new movements, and particularly more political movements, of course, whether they are potentially violent ones or not, emerge. They can only respond to that in terms of repression, and Uzbekistan is a good example of that. What you see in other Muslim majority states is an attempt to try and control the theological agenda, which is a bit more successful than what you get in countries like Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, where it's very ham-fisted, and the ability of those states actually to sort of fully control the new ideas of Islam is about Islam, which are being sort of encouraged by different groups, is quite limited.
Here, I also want to add. Yes, Dr. Jalab, I was coming just to you, so please,
if I
please
may,
go ahead.
Quickly add on to this.
Sure.
I would just continue on with some points that Bruce and Jonathan made regarding this religion until this the independence in Central Asia, having been more of a cultural matter, and as a result, also the education, knowledge of Islam, of the doctrinal Islam being very low, that really applies to the political elite and to the incumbent government as well. And taking the example of Kyrgyzstan is quite instructive, because until recently, Kyrgyzstan has been, and still continues to be, in fact, the more liberal, the more open political space for the exercise of religious practice, for rise of religious movements. But just recently, looking at various groups and what John has been referring to, the pietistic practices of Islam in different schools of Islamic practice, the government has started to see that as an emerging threat that may run out of control at some points, even though the actual extent of how dangerous or threatening it is still rather unknown. And the government is now developing this idea or distinction between what they call the traditional Islam as opposed to what they would usually refer to as the either radical or extreme or simply imported Islam. And they put that in the language of different mashabs, different schools of thought in Islam, or in more secular languages of cultural Islam or local Islam. But in the end, what it shows is really this lack of depth or lack of true knowledge or awareness of how Islam is practiced and what it really means for societies in Central Asia. I think the governments are not far from the general society in this sense.
Yes, Alicia, jump in. Yeah.
Yeah. My point is that I'm talking about Uzbekistan. So in Uzbekistan, what President Karimov learned that day in Namangan was he saw Islam not as the as a rival, as a political rival, that it's something real that they will come to power if not you. So what you want to do is to try to use that. That's why after he left, they voted for him, because he made certain promises that he will come back to the issue of Islamic State in Uzbekistan and put it into parliament discussion and make it happen. So they believed him, but when he came to power, he still saw that, perceived them as a major threat that would provide another alternative for Uzbekistan to develop in a completely different way. So, and the struggle over the past 23 years was to try to keep them in the regime which he's building, rather than to allow them to build their own regime, you know. So this is the balancing which he's having for 23 years, you know. So, and that's why all these things of interpretation comes in. So that the moderate Islam is good for our state, you know, and the Islam which wants politics, this is obviously bad Islam in the current interpretation. It doesn't matter whether you're promoting peaceful means to struggle. If you're promoting political things, if you're promoting the anti-corruptional agendas or criticizing the regime, or just general stuff that would normal opposition would do, and if you're mixing it with Islam, so you already immediately turn into extremist and you end up in jail. So this is how it was for the past 23 years for Karimov.
I mean, just coming in on that, the problem, of course, is that step to see pietist movements, I'll use that term again, as a threat, and that's based on both this, as Bruce and Emil were mentioning, this division between national, proper national forms and foreign threats, which are then often, very often, seen as political, even if they're not, even if some of the missionary movements, such as Tablighi Jamaat, which is not illegal in Kyrgyzstan, but is pretty much everywhere else in Central Asia, for example, even if their notions of social mobilization are about changing people's to make them in some way more pious rather than addressing government. So even such movements then are seen as threats by, certainly by Islam Karimov, and are then criminalized. And, you know, that as a security strategy, that makes sense within his sort of way of thinking about security. But it's not at all clear that that's an effective way of addressing the situation of a society which is in various and diverse ways becoming let's say, more Muslim or Islamizing.
So what's the status of Islam today? Are we talking the radicalization of a society, Muslims in Central Asia? Of course, it varies region to region and country to country. Whether it is fault of the government, whether it's the increasing religious feeling of people, or whether it's imported from outside. So are we talking further Islamization or radicalization of the society here? Bruce?
Well, I suppose this is a good point to bring up something that I wanted to speak about too, is that every country has their specific, every government in Central Asia has their specific policy toward religion. What I've been struck by from traveling around Central Asia for the last more than 20 years is that, and Turkmenistan is an exception here, but generally the countries Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, I'm going to name, that have been more cautious and more restrictive, more invasive into the religion, have provoked a backlash, which has actually worked exactly against the government's interests. Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, but especially Kyrgyzstan, has been much more tolerant of a lot of these groups and let them practice. You know, and Hizb ut-Tahrir is one that I'll mention immediately because I've been in mosques in southern Kyrgyzstan where Hizb ut-Tahrir people are allowed to pray. You know, and by the nature of that particular movement, they advocate nonviolent means of getting their goals, but Kyrgyzstan really hasn't had religious-based violence and hasn't produced religious-based opposition groups so much. Whereas, you know, you look at Uzbekistan, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, we have Jamaat Ansarullah, which a lot of people think it probably is the Tajik wing of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. The Kazakhs didn't really have a problem with any religious group until they started to crack down on Salafis in the northwest. And then that provoked a response, which was exactly what they didn't want. So it's very strange. You know, like I said, Turkmenistan has almost total control over the society in general. So they haven't had these kind of problems at all. But it seems to be that the more restrictive the government policy is toward religion, the more radical some elements of society, of the religious society, become.
John, you had an interesting angle to look at the Islam and Islamism in Central Asia. And obviously, there are lots of arguments that they increasingly being radicalized through various factors. So is there anything you would like to add to Bruce's point here?
Yes, I would. I mean, your question, Mohammed, sort of suggested that there was a relationship between Islamization and radicalization. Sure. Now, these are two separate things, and it's really important, and academic researchers who study this field know this, not to confuse the two. There are forms of Islamization that can stay squarely within secularism. You know, Islam Karimov going on Hajj is in a very superficial way an expression of new opportunities to express Islam. There are lots of other signs of that in Central Asia. So you can have Islamization which still stays within the boundaries of a secularized Islam. You can also have Islamization which is essentially about piety and about adopting Islam as a social and moral system but isn't really explicitly political. Radicalization is extremely rare in Central Asia if we're talking about political articulations against the state, which is challenging the authority of the secular state. That is rare compared with other Muslim majority regions. And it's not at all clear that radicalization drops out of or follows directly from Islamization. It may well be produced in quite different ways. Some understandings of radicalization show that it's often a reaction to, yes, sometimes explicitly anti-Islamic policies, perhaps. It may also be a reaction more generally to the situations of living on the margins of a secular and secularizing society. And we see that, for example, in other regions where Muslims are a minority, like Europe. So it I would really want to be cautious not to slip between thinking about Islamization and radicalization. I think Kyrgyzstan is probably pretty unique to Kazakhstan in some sense too, to accept that these things are different. I think the general trend in Central Asia is to deal with Islamization and radicalization as being completely consistent things, and certainly that's what you see in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, and that's a real problem.
You know, then I will take this this category one step higher, talking about extremism here. And whatever the states of Islam was during the Soviet Union, today we don't know the exact numbers, but some of the Central Asian countries become an exporter of terrorism. Like just yesterday, there was a news from Kazakhstan, one of the top officials saying that 300 Kazakh militants are fighting among the Syrian and Iraq. And also, we know unknown numbers are also found in Afghanistan, in tribal region of Pakistan, and we don't know how many Uzbeks are in these places, in those countries. Alisher is here to tell about this. I mean, then what led to this transition from revival of Islam in Central Asia, then Islamism, then radicalism? Now we have extremism issue there. How this transition took place, Alisher?
To go back a bit back, I totally agree with Bruce that each country should be reviewed separately, sure. You know, in terms of the policy, because they're very different. In some ways similar, but in a critical way, they're very different. What we have in Uzbekistan is the most local analysts believe it ideal recipe for getting radicalized. So you have the regime, which controls the whole way of life, which criminalized lots of things, wearing hijab, having beards, you know, criminalized. It is in Uzbek criminal code today, this stuff, which does not allow you to practice Islam freely or even listen to those imams that government decided to jail at some point. So they were allowed to... For many years, like for 5-10 years, these were official normal imams, and all of a sudden government didn't like them and jailed them. And since whenever they jailed them, so what all the recordings that you have from him, you have to throw them out. You have the perfect recipe for radicalization. You have poverty, you have corruption, you have injustice, you know, in the courts. So basically, and you have unemployment, and you have a lot of population leaving to Russia. So if you add to this just a little bit of agitation, you know, Islamic type of propaganda, so you probably potentially having those radical group of people, especially with the. We now seeing that a majority of those people coming from Russia to Turkey to Syria and Iraq. So the trace of the radicalization is very telling you how things developing. So imagine you are a guy unemployed in Uzbekistan from Namangan. Yeah, you have the background of being very religious in the family. So you know you, probably your father or your uncle is jailed for being religious. You already have a huge discontent with the regime. Now you are unemployed. So your next step is to go to Russia. You go into Russia. In Russia, you see Russians. You see they drinking vodka. You see infidels in a way. You see that what your uncle was saying was right. That it is not the good way for us to go. Then you see that those infidels, you know, from their point of view, they are also nationalists. They beat you in Moscow. You see that your friend died in Moscow just for being Muslim or for being from Central Asia. So then you see that the police in Russia is not very like you. You know, they take bribes. They torture you in many cases, imprison you, extort bribes from you. So, and you see that it's not very comfortable living even here. You're not comfortable in Uzbekistan. You're not comfortable in Russia. So, and now you have a new alternative. You go, you're hearing news that some in some place, somebody created Islamic State for you. So, and you can contribute to that. So you want to die for it. So it's a very, and this is not, I'm not talking about a very few number of people. I'm talking about probably about hundreds of faiths that we were able to talk with. One of the guy who contacted us, he used to work in police, and he said, I used to torture people and I didn't like that. And I'm in and then he was unemployed, then came back to Russia, then he regretted what he done, you know, in his previous life, and he went to become, you know, Islamic State member. So these things, you have a hell of a lot of recipes to become radical in from Uzbekistan, especially these days.
May I come in on this? Because I think I would agree with a lot of what Alicia said about the way individuals may experience as processes of radicalization. But there's some things which are important here to add. So, I mean, it's the case that those conditions that have generally been described have been present in Uzbekistan for a very long period of time and in other parts of Central Asia. Yet Central Asia has been relatively exceptional in the Muslim majority world in experiencing far less presence of radical political groups which challenge its regimes. That is probably because the political environments have been such where the ability of organizations to emerge to challenge hegemonic governments has been extremely difficult. And also, I think, because of this tradition of secularized Islam, which has meant the support for radical groups is from a limited pool. So there is an absence of that organizational outworking of challenging regimes in this way, and that needs to be acknowledged. The conditions which might lead us to expect radical groups to emerge have been present for a long time, but they have emerged very minimally, very little at all, within the territories of the Central Asian republics. So the question of Central Asians going to fight with Islamic State is a different question, and it's a question about a global movement of political Islam. And it's important to note that whilst there may be hundreds going from Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, there are many hundreds going from almost every Muslim majority country in the world and from countries where Muslims are a minority. So although we don't know the figures and we need to be very, very cautious about estimates, it's quite likely there are proportionally more Muslims traveling from the United Kingdom and from Belgium than there are from Central Asian states, based on the estimated figures we have and the numbers of the Muslim populations. Now, the other important fact there is that it's happening almost everywhere, yeah? Because of the tragedy and the sheer, the craziness of the situation in Iraq and Syria, because of the conditions of armed conflict, Muslims from many parts of the world are drawn there. So this is a general problem, and it's one that can be understood in terms of the situations of armed conflict that we have. And it's in those situations of protracted armed conflict, which thankfully in Central Asia we've not seen since the Tajik Civil War, where really radicalization is fostered and takes root and really occurs. It's in the conditions of armed conflict.
I wanted to go back to Dr. Emil, but we lost him. Bruce, you might jump in.
You know, the only point that I'm going to add to what's just been said here is that, this was kind of the contemporary general wisdom about 10 years ago, even more than that, was that the rise of Islamic radicalism in Central Asia, such as it was or is today, was in great part due to the fact that the governments, particularly I'll use Uzbekistan, for example, had stamped out all the secular opposition in the country. And if you were an opponent of the government, you were left with limited options for expressing your dissatisfaction with the government, and that led to the creation of a group like the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. But it appeared after groups like Birlik and Erk and others had been stamped out entirely. So it became the only way to resist the government was to join. At least that was the thought, that this was the only way to resist the government. You have to join one of these groups because they were active, and that they did, someone like the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan was making news for opposing the Uzbek government and advocating some kind of change in society. Maybe everyone wasn't behind all the ideas of the IMU, but at least they were out there doing something about it. And you get kind of the same impression from the so-called Islamic State, where a lot of disaffected Muslims from different countries are going there because they see, one, this group is actually making progress, but they're out there getting, they do in some ways, I suppose, kind of speak for the disaffected Muslims in a lot of countries, and here's your chance to participate in in moving forward and showing your support for the religion, in a lot of cases misguided. But you know, we should add that if the governments in Central Asia had been a little more tolerant of some of the secular movements in their countries, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan and Tajikistan too, they might find themselves in a different situation than they do today.
I'm taking back the discussion a little bit, our earlier subject, but just to give a microphone to Dr. Emil to add his point in this. Dr. Emil, we were talking about Central Asia being the region of relatively moderate Muslims. Then what happened that some of the Central Asians started going outside and joining various militant groups like Islamic State in Iraq? So Kyrgyzstan being mentioned always as an exceptional country, like a secular country. So today I heard that 150 Kyrgyz are officially mentioned, are fighting among the IS mm-hmm. in Iraq or in Syria. What is happening? What is leading Kyrgyz people to go and join those groups? Dr. Emil Juraev? It seems we lost Dr. Juraev. Dr. John, you having an extensive work on the subject, what would you say about this trend?
Well, I suppose I'd just actually like to return, if that's okay, to this final point around recruitment for Islamic State. I mean, well, just in addressing it, I know it less in the Kyrgyz context than the Tajik one, okay? So the little bit of research we've been doing here at Exeter, one of my doctoral students, Ed Lemon, who's appeared in your work before, has been identifying how, you know, people are often, they may be Tajik, but because of the nation of migration economies, and this is also true in Kyrgyzstan, it's not necessarily that there are recruitment networks which are essentially organized in Central Asia. It is in Russia and Moscow and transnational communities, Islamist communities, which are present there that might occur. And that seems to be the case in terms of the Tajik examples, which I know better, to be honest. So, again, thinking about what's internal and external to the region here is really important. We can keep talking about Islamic movement to Uzbekistan, and we think it's a Central Asian organization because it's got Uzbekistan in the title, but the reality is it's primarily operating out of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it moves around that region at the moment, which is external to the five Central Asian republics. So thinking about the ability of individuals and groups to organize within the entirely repressive political space of Uzbekistan, certainly, and across much of Central Asia is really, really important to understand this. And it works both ways. Speakers are absolutely right, Alisha and Bruce, that the repression of political dissent does provide a stimulus, perhaps, to opposition emerging from religion, from Islam. But equally, it closes down political space and makes it very difficult to organize politically also for these religious groups. And that's, I'm afraid, and I don't want to give credit to authoritarians here, but it's part of the reason why such groups have not emerged. It's not a policy which is going to be effective in the long run, but it is that lack of political space in Central Asia is why we see mobilization also overseas and less so within Central Asia.
So, yes, there is a role of the government, lack of the political pluralism in Central Asia, which led to this situation today. And yes, as Alisha mentioned, there's a role of poverty in this mess. Dr. John, you also mentioned that there are also increasing challenge just coming up not very far. By 2014, international forces will be leaving Afghanistan. So obviously there will be more challenge coming up on the step door of the Central Asian countries. So, Going forward, what should be done to avoid further problems? What states should not do what they have been doing in the past throughout these independence years to avoid further problems in terms of this extremism or radicalism or Islamism, let's put it that way? Alisha?
Yeah, when you first said that there is a topic like that, I was very much curious how we would respond to all these questions, because they are very very basic and very difficult to respond. You have five countries in Central Asia with very different policies towards Islam. You know, on one hand you have Karimov, who was suppressing radicalization for 23 years and with some progress, of course, but some believe that he created more radicals than he eradicated. Another policy is of Kyrgyz policy, where they did not suppress on radicals, but they created a belt of in southern Kyrgyzstan, there's a belt of radical ideology, yeah. You know, where we hear imams from that region. Just yesterday, I heard a Kyrgyz imam, and he was saying stuff like that all this propaganda on IS is wrong, which is distributed by BBC and Radio Free Europe. So you have that total freedom of expression in that sense, in that region, but you're also opening the way for radical propaganda in that region. So, and now we know that many people from Kyrgyzstan, Kyrgyz South is becoming hub for radicals to travel to Syria and Iraq these days. So you have Karimov, who was hard on radicals and having the same result, and you have Kyrgyzstan, which was you know, more liberal and having even maybe worse results, if not the same. We don't know. You have Tajikistan, where Islamists were able to go into politics. They were allowed to have their own political party, and you have the other problems in this sense as well. So you have Kazakhstan, where people enjoyed a lot of economic freedoms, becoming rich, but on the other hand, becoming also religious and being able to sponsor at some point, since the wealth and religious radicalization is could be even more dangerous if you're able to finance these things, you know. So it's very complex, very difficult. Difficult question. How do you want to alter your politics in terms of religion, so you are not ending up as creating radicals? So that's why I believe this is very complex, and it should be taken. The policy should not be concentrated on religion per se. So rather, it should be concentrated on economic freedoms, on totally different sets of things, you know, on justice, on creating just system where people believe courts, even on healthcare, you know, even when you have people in Uzbekistan, for example, they don't believe the healthcare, and they go to religious tabibs, you know, to cure the cancer, you know, because normal healthcare cannot cope with that. So you have to really, if you want to have less radicals, so you have to take it from the angles you would not even expect. So just increase jobs, you know, have better economic freedoms, more political freedoms, more freedom of speech. It's very, 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 I think, difficult task for the current regimes at this point, which is even not even possible, I would say.
It is interesting to hear this local perspective in this subject. Dr. John, what would be your response to the question I just asked to Alisher?
We have to be very careful in using the word radical, and I think we need to make a distinction between people who see Islam as a source of moral authority and a driving force for their lives as pious people, and those that are actually seeking to challenge the basis of the secular form of power. So I think most people in Central Asia are very much, if they are Islamizing, if they are expressing themselves as Muslim, and if they're raising concerns privately, mainly with the nature of political power in their states, then they're doing so in the former sense of Islam as a source of moral authority, and Islam as a call to political action or any attempt to recreate a caliphate or actually introduce Islamism. And that's true of, say, most members of the Islamic Revival of the Party of Tajikistan, which has been mentioned. They're not really Islamist in the proper sense of what that means. They're not trying to de-secularize political power in Tajikistan. They are seeking political space to engage in political practice that is the mainstream of the party. There are some in the party that would be radical, probably, but that's not the mainstream. So the real challenge then for Central Asian regimes, and I don't really expect this to be the direction in which they go, but is to make those distinctions, as I think at times Kyrgyzstan has done, between groups that are about expressions of Islam as a source of moral authority, and groups which are offering a political challenge to the state and potentially, particularly those that are using violence to do so. That distinction between non-violent and violent expressions is really, really important. If groups which aren't using physical violence are using hate speech, then I think there's a grounds to control them and potentially use the law against them. But making that distinction between forms of Islam as a moral articulation and political forms which are actually offering a challenge to the fundamental basis of the secular state is difficult to make. And I think particularly because most Central Asian regimes lack a strong basis of moral authority, and they are vulnerable to the challenge that religion offers as a way of thinking about politics. And so they're much more likely to go the security route of simply repressing all forms of collective expression of Islam, social and political, pietist and Islamist, that they see. And that is that in the long term, that is a problem, and that is dangerous, and that is likely to be counterproductive.
Bruce, here I would like to have a brief comment from you to the question, what should be the tiny line governments of Central Asia should be taking to deal with this challenge in the future?
You know, I hate to look to the past to find a possible solution from the future, but it needs to be pointed out that in the days of the Emirates and Khanates of Central Asia, the ruler was very close to the religion all the time. That doesn't mean that the religion couldn't have been a unifying element that could overthrow the ruler, but the emirs and Hans were seen as being pious people in themselves too. That's almost impossible given the current leadership of Central Asia, because almost all of them were former communists. So no pious Muslim in Central Asia is going to look at Nazarbayev, Karimov, any of those people praying and believe that these are pious Muslims. So we're going to have to buy a little time here. But traditionally in Central Asia, leadership and religion have gone hand in hand. It doesn't mean that the emirs and Hans weren't trying to control the religion. They always did, of course. But the general population saw the leader as also being a Muslim. And that solved some problems within the society, because at least they had the impression that the Han or Emir was guided by Islamic principles to some extent. You know, again, to get back to that, given the current leadership, I don't see where that is possible, because there's going to be some people that are just never going to buy the fact that their leaders are that pious. You know, you hate to say that there has to be a mixture of religion and state, because, you know, being from the United States, of course, we say there's got to be clear separation. But Central Asia almost has to work that way. And for that to be true, you're going to need a leader that is perceived as not only being a good leader, but also as a moral authority to the people. And for that, you're going to need someone who's much closer to the Quran than who we have now.
Just last note, since it's going to be very strange to hear from me this point, since I'm Muslim myself, but I see very narrow difference between Islamization and radicalization. I see Islamization as the early trajectory towards radicalization. So if you allow Islamization, you will have the same trajectory in the long run, anti-Americanism, anti-Semitism. It comes with this. It is written in the book. You cannot erase that. If you're Islamized, you obviously cannot avoid a question of jihad. It is there. It is written. It is clear. I mean, if you're Islamized, there is a way to get radicalized at some point. This is trajectory. You cannot avoid this. So everything is in the book. So, and the radicals and Islamists, they're reading the same book in just from different perspective. These guys are reading it more tough than others. So radicalization is basically a response to grievances, to unjust. It's the radicalization is the action to alter the situation. So you can have normal Islamization under prosperous democracy, like in Malaysia, in Turkey. But if you don't have this prosperous democracy or walls that would hold Islamization within its own frameworks, it's gonna fall and turn into radicalization. So that's why the methods that are being used by current regimes, I think this is the maximum they could come up with at this, given their own characters, given that they don't want to fall from power. This is the, and as Bruce rightly pointed out, I think it just we're just prolonging the day when the region completely falls under radicalization.
I know, Dr. John, you have an opposing view about this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid as an academic, I struggle with that because it's a deterministic analysis. It says that in conditions of poverty, that those who become more observant Muslims then radicalize. And there's a number of problems with that. Firstly, there are always many factors explaining a people's action. Secondly, there is the fact that people can be ambiguous to the point of being contradictory. It's possible to hold many secular beliefs alongside holding ones which are pretty radical from a religious perspective, actually. And, you know, you can go to all kinds of sacred texts to find things which call a person to very radical or militant action, which people who are genuine and highly observant believers in that faith don't then take literally, okay? So there's different ways of approaching one's religious faith. And thirdly, there's the simple fact that there are many poor Muslim countries where radicalization isn't a major problem. I would point to large parts of, say, for example, West Africa, where I lived before and where I were focused on regionally. So it is, there's lots of examples where it is too, and it often takes place around situations of political instability. And yes, in parts, poverty and chronic problems of societal development. But it doesn't always take place. And a deterministic analysis which suggests that Islamization is followed closely by radicalization in cases of poverty is just very unsatisfactory and not convincing.
Bruce, wise remark at the end?
You know, all the elements are there for I know some people don't think there is such thing as a moderate Muslim. I disagree, having lived with them, that's true. All the elements are there to produce exactly the kind of society that Dr. Hedleshaw has been talking about, that has elements of both secularism and religion side by side and in no way in conflict with each other. This generation of leaders that's in power now is just not the right generation to do it. We're really looking at who comes after these guys and how they're going to interpret this. Are they going to be nationalist leaders who will cause more problems and use and twist the religion to their own political ends? Or are they going to be able to find that common ground, you know, that says we are Muslim, but we are liberal and we are looking forward and we're part of the 21st century and the contemporary world at the same time. That's really the question, but unfortunately we're not going to know the answer to that for 5-10 years at least.
And that's the important point. It's not the conditions of being more Muslim and being poor which creates radicalization. There's an intervening issue, which is politics and political choices by regimes that are exacerbating many of the problems in Central Asia, as we've discussed, particularly in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, in my view.
Thank you, Dr. John. With that final note, we should conclude our discussion today. And it was great talking to you, Bruce Panier, Alisher Sadiq, Dr. John. I wish I could say bye to Dr. Emil Juraj, but he's not anymore with us. So thank you very much, gentlemen, for the fascinating discussion today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.